Hey everyone, it's Duncan Crary. You're listening to the Kunstlercast, a weekly conversation about the tragic comedy of suburban sprawl featuring James Howard Kunstler. Jim is the author of The Long Emergency, The Geography of Nowhere, and The World Made by Hand novels. On today's show, we're going to be playing part two of our discussion on Charles Waldheim's talk about landscape urbanism at the Congress for the New Urbanism No. 19 held in June in Madison, Wisconsin. Charles Waldheim is professor and chair of landscape architecture at the Harvard Graduate School of Design. He is one of the leaders of the landscape urbanism movement. On today's show, we'll play some clips from his talk at CNU, and I strongly encourage everyone who's interested to watch the entire video recording of both Professor Waldheim's talk at the CNU and Andres Duany's response. You can search around at cnu.org for that, or I will put the direct link to the video at kunstlercast.com in the show notes for episode number 165. After we hear from Waldheim and Jim reacts to some of the quotes, I'll play some more from Andres Duany, and we'll respond to a question from one of the conference goers. Jim, here's a point that you might agree with that Waldheim made.
We have enormous challenges environmentally, socially, and culturally. And it's also clear that urban planning as an academic discipline is in a moment of crisis. If you look at the literature in the course of the last decade or so, there's quite abundant literature. This is the Harvard Design Magazine recent retrospective on urban planning. And to the extent planning has essentially abandoned a physical planning practice in favor of the kind of demographics and social sciences and juridical models, there is, of course, an opportunity there that the new urbanism has exploited, I think, quite smartly.
Oh, yeah, you'd have to agree with that. Urban design is it's no longer urban design. One of the reasons that they even call it urban planning rather than design is because design has pretty much been absent for, 70 years. It's just been about statistical analysis and traffic engineering and math-driven considerations and sociology. And it hasn't been about a really coherent, integral practice that calls, not just for the math and the science, but also for the artful construction of places that people care about. But the ironic thing is that that's really quite absent in Charles Waldheim's version of landscape urbanism. That, they are interested in the geography and the hydrology and a menu of environmental concerns, but they don't show any particular interest in, they're back to Ian McCarg and Design with Nature, really, where they're just kind of making apologies for the human presence. And so if you don't become sympathetic with the human imprint itself and regard it as something that, has value, you're not going to design for it. And I don't think that they really do, other than their preoccupation with parks.
So, Jim, let's play some more of Charles Waldheim's comments about Ian McCarg, because we've mentioned him a couple times.
And that's a very, very different formulation than Ian's own formulation. For McCarg, of course, urbanization and the human species was a cancer on the planet. And McCarg, of course, invoked the Apollo photograph of the Earth and invoked a whole series of precedented strategies for viewing the Earth from above, in which urbanization was the problem, and the very project of ecological planning, identifying where not to build or where not to urbanize, of course, was a fundamental game-changing, paradigm-shifting moment.
So, McCarg is really himself coming out of this Frederick Law Olmsted tradition of using nature as the fundamental remediation for the presence of human beings on the planet. And we've never quite gotten over that. And, a lot of it has to do with the fact that America is such a new place, and our cities are relatively new. They even now, after all the layers of stuff that's been imposed on the landscape, we don't really have a lot of meaningful history in our cities, at least in the urban residue that's there. And so we keep on returning to this tactic or strategy, which is we're gonna continue trying to make up for the deficiencies of our towns and cities by bringing nature into the picture and by ruralizing the city. And so the landscape urbanism program, I think, it is at the very center of it, is this very misguided idea about ruralizing the whole idea of urbanism. You know, that it's, and it's terribly unfortunate, because among the biggest confusions that has left us in our predicament today is this idea that, you know, we're not quite sure what's the city, what's not the city, what's the suburb, you know, what is the country, what are the activities that go on in each, and, you know, why bother having a difference? You know, in a way, it's yet another unfortunate product of living in a relativistic society where everything appears or is described as being the same, when in fact it's not. You know, the rural places are not urban, and the urban places are not rural. And if you're going to have an urban place, you really have to follow some urban principle. And landscape urbanism is all about just pushing dirt around with bulldozers and putting riprap in the water courses and maybe taking a water course that has been in a culvert and taking it out and making it back into a stream, and maybe hoping that in 200 years that, some native plant or animal is going to inhabit it. But, you know, the whole key to Olmsted was that his great works like Central Park and the Emerald Necklace in Boston were artifice. You know, they were artificial reconstructions of a landscape, but they weren't the original landscape. In a way, they were connected to literature. The landscape of Olmsted, you know, is supposed to sort of tell a story in vignettes, the way that a Sir Walter Scott novel would tell a story about, you know, knights in shining armor. So Central Park has its picturesque little vistas, you know, that are very carefully planned to sort of tell a story. You know, there's the little artificial castle that we built. You know, it was built in, you know, what was then modern times, but it was supposed to be a medieval castle in this landscape, and you can see it from this vista, and doesn't it tell a wonderful little tale? And here's the romantic bridge going over this narrow part of the lake, and, you know, it's like a romance out of Sir Walter Scott, and isn't it wonderful? And it is a wonderful construction, there's no question about it. But landscape urbanism is coming from just yet another kind of literary tradition, only it's the kind of dumb, misguided, contemporary, deconstructed nonsense, you know, that ran through the humanities of the elite colleges, you know, starting in the 1970s, and ended up being an abstraction of literature so severe that the literature basically disappeared. And landscape urbanism is a kind of an abstract, deconstructivist, literary exercise that is making the whole issue of urbanism disappear.
Jim, I want to play you another clip from Waldheim's talk about his attitudes regarding the European model for planning in the city.
At the same moment, I think urban design as a discourse and as a set of practices has been overly, too much invested in essentially a Eurocentric model of the city. Nothing against Europe. Having said that, I think each culture and each context is unique and different, and I'm committed to the idea of an organic American form of urbanism that's responsive to the conditions that we find ourselves in.
So, Jim, what do you think about this complaint that we've invested too much in trying to plan like Europe, or we look to Europe for guidance on these issues? What do you think about that?
Well, what I think is that, you know, we actually have very few models left in the United States to actually turn to instruct us how to do an urban place the right way. So there's no other place in Western culture to look these days. You could look at Asia too, but that's not Western culture, and you'd get a different outcome. You could look to the Middle East, but that's, you know, climactically different, and you get a much different urban outcome. So we tend to look to Europe because they have the greatest residue of really fine and excellent urbanism. There was quite a bit of it in the United States, but The amount of it that's been destroyed is just so fantastic. And, you know, one of the things that impresses me so much when I go around to the backwaters of the USA, you know, if I go to a place like Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and I remember staying in a hotel there, and, you know, somehow I got a whole bunch of old photographs of Sioux Falls. There might have been a book in the hotel room, you know, even. But, you know, you looked out the window from the hotel window, and all of their heritage was just lost. And the stuff had been replaced with, you know, one-story muffler shops and you know, fast food joints and just the usual furnishings of that we're now familiar with in, you know, the American landscape. But there once had been a pretty good town there. And that's true of most towns in the United States that existed before the Second World War. You know, most of them had some good urban form. You know, they had their centers, they had their vibrant downtowns and main streets. The buildings, you know, they weren't medieval buildings, and, you know, they didn't have cathedrals, and, you know, they hadn't been reused. They didn't have buildings that had been reused for 17 generations and you know, that had layer upon layer of value added to them in one way or another. But they were there. But now they're gone. So, you know, naturally, you turn to the places in Western culture that can, you know, instruct you and furnish you with some principle and knowledge for how to go back and rebuild something. By the way, you know, it's not as though the new urbanists are not trying to build, you know, a Disney-type European village when they do this stuff. I think that they're very attentive to the idea that we have our own urban forms in the USA, and they've tried to rediscover them and rediscover what is best in them and put them to some use. But it's a struggle. So the bottom line is, you know, what are the models that landscape urbanism is looking for in whatever it is they construe to be urban design? And I would maintain is that I don't think they're looking at anything that's truly urban. You know, they're looking at really, you know, the abstract sculptural art of the 1970s and 80s and the, you know, site planning practices of, you know, dealing with water flows and not a whole lot else.
Okay, Jim, let's play Waldheim's sort of closing thoughts here. Just before this clip, Charles Waldheim gives a pretty lengthy description of Lafayette Park in Detroit, which he cites as a landscape urbanism prototype construct that actually has people living in it.
One of the interesting stories here, to bring this to a close and to share a little bit about why I think this is such an important analog to some of the engagements that you've been working on, has been the historic reception of Lafayette Park. Because I did 6 years of architecture school. I was very pleased to come out with a degree in architecture and get my license and practice as an architect. I never saw a single lecture. It's as if it never happened. There was one project from the 1920s that Hilbes did. It was seared into the back of our retinas in the 1980s as what not to do, and we moved on. But when you actually look at the literature, the project was quite well documented, certainly in the professional press. You can see here Architectural Forum and a range of other publications published it with drawings. I particularly like this piece. It may be too small for you to see. It says, six families with a stake in downtown. And it interviews, in fact, six of the early residents of Lafayette Park, one African-American couple, a judge, a firefighter, a couple of school teachers. And it gives you a sense of the social commitment, the social idea of constructing community. And, of course, I've interviewed several of the original residents and, of course, people who still live there. And it is true that by now there is a disproportionate population of people that are drawn there for its design genealogy, let's say. But having said that, there are extraordinary stories. I've interviewed people who told me that they were in 1967 at the pool having a barbecue with mixed-race couples as Detroit was in flames. And I don't mean to caricature that. I don't mean to make this a panacea. I don't think that this solves everything socially and environmentally. But what I do want to suggest is that history matters. The precedents that we look at matter. The construction of that history is an active, ongoing engagement that we're invested in. And I think that we have to continually revisit our historical models and our narratives so as to refashion them so as to be both true and useful for today. This is a journal article from 1967. By an unknown doctoral student in London called one Charles Jenks. It's a chapter from what becomes his dissertation, modestly titled The Problem of Mies. This is at a moment in 67 when, to think of Mies, you would probably have to think of the architect who has the greatest single name recognition globally. I think that's true. I might have to defend that a little bit, but let's say in the top two or three. He was also producing residential buildings cheaper per square foot than his competitor. And if you can combine that, you get a sense of the kind of star power. And of course, a part of what Jenks was attacking was the celebrity that had accrued to Mies and the extent to which he felt as though Mies's work would not be remembered favorably in history. And in fact, Jenks goes on in this early paragraphs to claim that Mies's architecture is doomed to only be regarded as minor architecture. And then he goes on to give us the benefit of his years of insight about, well, what exactly would Professor Jenks be a major architecture? And he goes on to enumerate it. And many of these are now evocative foreshadowing elements that would become tenets of the New Urbanist project. Of course, in that regard, the idea that modernism would be indicted for its social failures is, of course, a debate about the relationship between effect and cause. And in that history, while, of course, there are extraordinary challenges with recuperating a modernist planner, I do want to suggest that for my generation, I think that the pendulum has gone so far away from the capacity to think about the shape of the city that I think we have to revisit that history and with a critical eye, but also with a sense of open-mindedness and a sense of generosity of spirit and intellectual curiosity, see, are there exemplars of an ecologically leavened, socially progressive, and culturally informed urbanism? And I think the answer is, of course, there are. And then the other question will be, well, is there only one model? Should one size fit all problems? And to the extent in your own program you continually co-opt and absorb great ideas, that's to your credit. Having said that, I think that there's a danger that ultimately by co-opting the next best idea each time, if each one of them maps so easily back onto the 19th century street grid, one begins to get a little skeptical about, well, really, if we're studying these things empirically, there must be a moment when that model runs aground or finds a point of friction. For my own purposes, I think it's striking to me how much of Lafayette Park and some of the projects of an ecologically or proto-ecologically informed urbanism resonate with the fundamental tenets of the New Urbanist Project. Just reading the New Agrarian Urbanism pamphlet, on chapter 2, page 31, chapter 2 trunk New Urbanism, a kind of restatement of the fundamental tenets, the idea that certain neighborhoods produce the following attributes. One, the neighborhood is the standard urban increment, which when clustered with others becomes a town, and standing in the landscape becomes a village. The density varies according to the natural and social circumstances. I think that explanation could easily stand in for Lafayette Park. I think all of those things will hold. Secondly, the neighborhood, Hilbes called it the neighborhood unit, is limited in size so that a majority of the population is within a 5-minute walk of its center. That's certainly true at Lafayette Park. The basic needs of daily life are available within this pedestrian shed, whose center should provide a transit stop, workplaces, shops, and community facilities. All of those were true. The public school, the bank, the local corner market, etc., in addition to a range of recreational amenities and forms of transit, both mass and also individual. Third, there is a network of thoroughfares providing alternate routes to most destinations. Of course, we can talk about hierarchy. I expect that conversation will come up shortly. These can be smaller with slower traffic and allowing the provision of parking, trees, sidewalk, and buildings close up. They're equitable for people in vehicles, people on bicycles, and pedestrians, of course. The one piece that stands out from that is the fourth. The thoroughfares are spatially defined by buildings that confront the sidewalk in a disciplined manner, uninterrupted by the gaps of parking lots. Okay, so let's take a pause there. That's interesting. On that, I think there's a very substantive difference. There are enormous benefits to both social and environmental, not to mention cultural, to that form of street frontage. Having said that, I've got many more examples in addition to Lafayette Park in which a socially leavened, environmentally healthful urbanism can come without resorting to that one particular tool. And in respect to the work that you've done in the Congress, I would argue that we need alternatives. not that the work that you've been doing isn't quite consequential and important, but that ultimately we have real challenges ahead of us. I think we need to expand the range of alternatives beyond the new urbanism and landscape urbanism to a range of practices that would be both empirically, if not scientifically, informed, but also open-minded and simultaneously curious. That ultimately we have to address the challenges, environmental and social and cultural, that we face without necessarily suspecting that we risk losing our core values at that very moment. In that regard, I think that there's quite a lot that can be learned from this shared dialogue. I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you all very much for the invitation to be here, and I'll look forward to chatting with you.
So, Jim, do you have anything to respond to that, and then do you have any kind of closing thoughts on this talk?
I do think it's true that it's not entirely clear what the viable mechanism is going forward, but that's largely because the conditions that we're going to meet going forward are going to be so unlike what has been presenting itself to us in our time that we're really quite unprepared mentally for what we're going to have to do. And I don't think that landscape urbanism prepares us any more for it. In fact, it's really just kind of a dodge in the meantime. The conditions that are waiting to meet us are economic austerity, and this is far beyond even what we discuss when we talk about the debt crisis in Europe and the need for European nations to fire a few civil service employees and increase the retirement age. I mean, we're talking about a society where you're not going to be able to move a whole lot of stuff really long distances and where the organization of work is going to be way different than anything we can imagine now, where really different skills are going to be needed than the kind of skills that you get from sitting in a cubicle, where households are going to be organized differently. It's not just going to be a couple of adults or maybe one person living in a large place, All these things are going to be so different. And, this doesn't even include the potential for very unsettling weather problems and, population migration problems, food shortages, all these things. I think that the new urbanists are now keenly aware of the agricultural difficulties that we face, and they're trying to do something about it in their practice and their understanding. I think that they get fundamentally that if people can't live in urban places, that we're not going to save the landscape. And in fact, I think that the future is going to compel us to live in towns, villages, and cities again too. I just happen to think they're going to be smaller than they are now. That we are faced with a comprehensive contraction, and that includes population, and that includes the scale of everything we do. I don't think landscape urbanism is concerned with these things at all or aware of them. They just seem to think that the same amount of resources are going to be available generally, although, that there may be some, CO2 in the atmosphere related problems. But, I don't see in them any recognition that, for example, the skyscraper is going to be a problem in the future. That cities like New York and Manhattan that are full of these things, are full of megastructures, are going to be a problem. I don't see any recognition on their part that megastructures per se are problematic. In fact, the little that they have included in their design in the way of buildings are basically megastructures. I'm not persuaded that the landscape urbanists have anything to teach us now. And, it's just sort of for me, it's a continuation of Harvard's Graduate School of Design to maintain its status and appear to be morally superior because they're more concerned about environmental issues than other people. And to keep landscape architects employed, by doing giant heroic site plans for projects that we're probably not going to have enough capital to even undertake. So it's very hard to take them seriously. And finally, my own extemporaneous speaking style is not the model of perfection. But, you know, there were times when Charlie Waldheim sounded like he was delivering Lucky's speech from Waiting for Godot, you know, that it was so full of nonsense. And he just kept on, saying, having said that, it sounded like some kind of labored academic discourse that, you know, he'd been practicing for his PhD in a hotel room for 38 hours. And I don't know. I don't want to pick on him for that too much because, like I said, you know, I don't do this so well, so.
Well, it is difficult for some of us lay folk out there to follow these discussions sometimes.
But to put it in plain English, you know, it ended up just sounding like a lot of academic bullshit.
Yeah. All right, well, Jim, as you know, I ran into Andre Stuani afterwards. He gave sort of a rebuttal to Waldheim's talk.
Yeah, and by the way, you know, I want to say something about that. You know, Andres, who is, you know, kind of the undisputed new urbanist leader, really. I mean, not in the sense that he's a despot, but in the sense that, you know, he is the most actively involved in these battles. He's tried to emphasize how important it is to make this a polite discussion or a polite debate or argument. And, you know, he's complained a little bit that the landscape urbanists have undertaken this as though it was a knife fight, but he wants to conduct it as though it's a duel between gentlemen. You know, for better or for worse, I'm kind of a knife fighter myself, you know. But, you know, I don't have any institutional ties, and, I, you know, there's nothing's really holding me back. I don't have clients or customers or constituents or, you know, I don't even have colleagues, really. I mean, I'm just some lone wolf, you know, predatory author with a chip on his shoulder, you know, and a bad attitude. So
if somebody else said that about you, it would be on your next book jacket cover.
Yeah, well, okay. But so what I'm basically trying to do is apologize for the fact that, you know, I'm kind of uncomplimentary about this, and I'm not being entirely the gentleman about my end of the argument with this. And, you know, I'm sure they could find fault with that, but fuck them.
All right, well, let's hear what Andres told me about this.
Andres Stuani, Jim has told me and our listeners so much about you. It's a pleasure to speak with you in person.
Well, thanks for interviewing me when I'm brain dead. Excellent. After an entire day and a two-hour speech, I'm sure I will be at my best.
Well, I was very impressed by your response to an ambassador of the landscape urbanism. We were expecting there was going to be a knockdown, drag-out debate, and you both handled yourself very well, and I think you demonstrated that this is a fluid movement that's willing to accept new ideas. Am I categorizing that correctly?
Actually, it was a knockout fight, but done under the most civilized of circumstances. It's a lot more like Britain than, I think, the bar. And I think it's part of the... I think there's a seriousness because of climate change and the crises that we have, that perhaps the old games are really just passé, and we can really get something done. And we need to get something done, and it was great fun to have artificial... theological debate between the modernists and the traditionalists, etc. But it's really much more interesting and important to work together. What a cliche! I mean, really, Jim, I'm sorry. What a cliche! But I'm not sure who I'm speaking to, and I can't use swear words. So I can?
You can use all the swear words you want.
Okay. Well, now I can't think of any. But nevertheless, I think that it's really fucked up, and we need to. You know, it's well. Let's put it this way. The way the Southerners say, it's a slap upside the head. You know, we really do need to get serious about the crises we're in, and even the architects need to join in on that.
But you don't want people to ignore the landscape urbanism because people ignored you, the academics ignored the new urbanists, and you said 20 years to work sort of unimpeded. Is that correct? You don't want the same thing to happen to the landscape urbanists?
No, I actually think they have a lot to contribute. And I think that actually Charles Waldheim today showed the kind of quality of thinking and the clarity and just the breadth of knowledge. And I would give him a keynote every single CNU because, you know, the quality of the debate is of the highest order. And we all like to fight anyway. It's just we fight over dumb little things. And here we can talk about, we can actually fight over big, intelligent things. It's much more stimulating.
Well, of course, Andres was very gentlemanly about the whole thing. And I think that in many ways, I mean, he has his the rough edges of his personality, but he's a very generous spirit. And I think he articulates the situation pretty well. I don't know if we're going to be able to give up our internal squabbling in American culture over these things, or if we're just going to going to go down fighting with each other. I'm always suspicious of the "let's work together" slogan, because Ronald Reagan said it so many times, and every president since Ronald Reagan has said it a million times, and it sometimes ends up seeming like kind of an empty phrase. But this is an especially fragmented period of American history when, you know, we don't have a strong consensus about doing really anything. And in this field of how we construct the places that we live and work, the places where human civilization dwells, it would be nice if we could form a consensus there about what we're going to do. You know, I think circumstances are going to make us do that, and that we'll wake up some bright, shining morning, and the paradigm will have shifted during the night when we weren't looking, and we'll understand, of course, we have to build places that are, you know, towns that are real towns where we grow food outside of our town, and that's the country, and this is the town, and we've done it in a way that pleases us and makes us feel good about being here. And, I think we'll get to the point where we can settle that out. But in the meantime, it is a very interesting quarrel anyway, and I'm glad that we had our little part in it.
Well, Jim, there were two points in Andres' rebuttal that really resonated with me. I'm going to play them both one after another. The first one is in response to Waldheim's claim that the landscape urbanism projects, with people actually living in them, can be as dense as new urbanist projects. So let me just play these two rebuttal points right here, and I'll get your reaction.
I think one of the richest forms of criticism is the confusion of density and urbanism. I think there's a great deal on the worst projects, not your best projects, but a lot of the sort of simulacra that takes place in Asia, for example, in which because it's dense, it's considered urban, and it isn't. It's density without urbanism. There's a great danger of that. It's not the same thing. Okay. The second thing, which I think makes you vulnerable, is this sociology. Pedestrians are extremely demanding of their environment. And one of the things we've bred with is actually the retailers. One of the healthiest things New Urbanism have ever done is to actually have among us. And, you know, we are, in fact, we have broken down what I've heard you call, not today, the landscape urbanists aspire to break down cross-disciplinary boundaries. And one of the things that they wish to do so is by the authority of landscape, of nature, as manifested by landscape urbanism. The authority of nature, which is now the new ethics. The ethics is the world that nurtures us. By the requirements of nature, the architects will be made to behave and cooperate. The Department of Transportation will be made to cooperate. And there's an aspiration, a very clearly stated aspiration, I think virtually unfulfilled so far by landscape urbanism, to break down cross-disciplinary boundaries. We've done that. We've done this with afterburners. Right from the beginning in this group there are traffic engineers, there are landscape architects, there are architects, there are urbanists, there are planners, there are code writers, there are lawyers. And I'll tell you what cross-disciplinary boundaries is. It's not that we're together and we talk to each other. It's that every one of us has become every other thing. I know traffic engineers that can design facades. I can do traffic engineering. I can't tell whether you're a landscape architect or an architect or a traffic engineer.
And I think that the greatest glory of the landscape urbanism is how we individually have become generalists. It's not the organization as a whole that actually incorporates the disciplines. It's the fact that the retailer can draw a rendering worthy of an architect. And there's a complete communication, if not only as a team, but internally. You know, we really have bred a new kind of generalist. And I think that's going to be very hard to catch up on that, because as you said, we've had 20 years doing it. Now, what the retail consultants have taught us, because of this breaking down of disciplinary boundaries, is that retail has to understand human nature like no other endeavor, because the failure is immediate. Retail collapses like that. You're out of business in 6 months. You've never seen an understanding of sort of human nature, sociology, and I mean at the level of lighting, how people respond like the retailers, and that's bred into the new urbanists. And one of the things I can say is that of the many renderings that I see fabulously done with Photoshop, I really doubt that those humans are going to be there. They'd be there the way they're Photoshopped in. And I respectfully say that. And something that I found time and time again observing is that, well, unless it is, they're incredibly backed by density, at which point, yes, they will use the open space, whenever density is not there, the humans simply will not walk unless there are street frontages on the sidewalk. And that is absolutely empirical. So while you have, I think the propositions that you showed from Canada are actually quite credible landscape urbanist public spaces, because you do have that density that actually feeds the high line. But those plazas with the ghosted figures, in fact, are, I'm afraid that actually in retrospect, and I urge you not to fail on this, are not going to be inhabited the way you think. I think there's a lot more of respect that needs to be acquired for the traditional street frontage. And I could take you on a tour and show you the number of pedestrians and what happens. I mean, I've sat in a place and watched in Edinburgh how there's a beautiful park and a mediocre street frontage, and 90% of the pedestrians stay in the street frontage, even when correcting for what the destination might be. You got to watch out for that. The pedestrians may not happen. There are too many of these, of the vanity of the designer thinking, because my plaza is beautiful and because the landscaping is so important. By the way, a little bit of bad news. Nature is exceedingly important, is exceedingly attractive, because it is unpredictable. People will go into nature because you can actually stub your toe, break your ankle, be bitten by a snake, and it changes every time. What landscape architects do is not that interesting. You see the movie once, and it doesn't bring you back. So watch out for, I think it's vain to actually just think of people contemplating actually native species planted all in a row. It's good, but not that good. Okay, now. The other thing is, I do think actually that we're going to have an uncomfortable conversation, because we're actually two theologies. And this, I think, is fascinating. And I think we need to reconcile the two theologies. Whatever is said about the interests of landscape urbanists about carbon is different. And whatever urbanists say about water is not the same thing, and they're mutually contradictory. When you respect a body of water, a stream flow, and you respect it to the point not only of not clipping it, but not putting it in a tube, and actually setting it back and celebrating it with naturalistic landscape, you know, the riparian corridor coming through, not the embankment, you clip the grid. Okay, you clip the grid. And when you clip the grid, it has measurable effect on the potential density, and it has a measurable effect on the because it has a measurable effect on the transportation. For example, one of the fantasies that's going up now, and it's really underanalyzed, is actually what Manhattan would have been like. They're reconstructing Manhattan in its primeval condition. And it's an astonishing thing to see how much landscape there was actually in Manhattan. It was an amazingly complex and beautiful island. It wasn't just forested, it had events. And of course, all that has been denatured, completely denatured. And I understand, I can't verify this, you can only repeat what you hear, that there are 2,700 streams and pipes in Manhattan. 2,700 streams and pipes. You know, after all, topography, actually continually. Now, the regulatory regime, which actually is compatible with landscape urbanism, requires all those streams to be respected. You must actually not only leave them, but the pipe is anathema. There's a theology that says to pipe is dishonorable, let it drain, in fact, where it lands. The problem with that, if you actually draw Manhattan, or attempt to draw Manhattan with its stream of 2,700, even without the riparian corridors, it clips the grid to the extent that it is no longer a pervasive system that is able to distribute. You cannot have a taxi fleet in motion. And I haven't done the calculation, but I'm sure one of our engineers could do that. The density actually would drop to virtually nothing. So while nature would have been preserved on the island of Manhattan, it would have spread over 900 or 9,000 square miles all over New York State. So you actually begin to ask, is there a position in which some streams, at least, can be put in a pipe? Is it possible to actually make a grid in what we call T6 and T5, which is the urban core? Is the urban core not achieving environmental performance by other means? And those other means are that thousands, if not millions, of people are living willingly in denatured urbanism, precisely because denatured urbanism has its compensations. Yes, I do not have a garden or a field out my back door, but by God, I've got a street life out my front. And I think one of the problems with that, the Hilbersheimer projects, is that you neither, because of its density, those people living in that high rise, you neither have the garden in the back, which of course is a very wonderful thing to have, but you also don't have the street life in front. There are, in fact, it's an under-amenitized, neither garden nor street life. Why in the world would I live in a townhouse? A townhouse requires a town. Okay, or it's simply an inferior way of living that gives you a smaller yard. And I think that sooner or later, if we are going to have a really honest discussion, there needs to be an understanding of there are other positions, and they're the new urbanist positions about T5 and T6. So at the same time that I grant that in the lower transect zones, you know, the more natural ones, there is everything to be learned from landscape urbanism, everything. The design of the suburbs, the design of the single-family house, the parks that actually incorporate nature, nature itself as it is restored, all that is, in fact, everything to be learned. I do think that actually disqualifying the corridor street as an amenity is actually mortal to the agenda. And this is the challenge that I'm going to make. We will absorb the agenda, whatever you can offer in T3, T2, and T1. And I would say that if there isn't a reciprocal understanding and absorption of the corridor street and the sidewalk, it will actually become, again, unbalanced, and our hegemony will remain unchallenged, at least in the long run. You really need the full transect, and we need all the tools, and they need to be correctly applied. Now, one more thing that we're actually already measuring, the metrics. For example, the High Line. Our engineers have calculated that the High Line cost, and of course it is a spectacular project, and I love it, everybody adores it, everybody here adores it, but we know it for what it is. The High Line cost $30,000 a foot to build, okay? A street costs $700, a good street, with good concrete, good sidewalks, trees, and lamps, cost $700 a foot. Okay? That is an enormous multiplier. One of the things about the landscape urbanism that has become very, very clear to us who tried to learn from it is that it actually is fantastically expensive. And unless something is done about dealing with the reality, it cannot make a proposition that it's an urbanism. It will always remain the special park, the special plaza, which is what it is now. You've challenged yourself, and I've heard you say this. Yes, we've done this until 10 years. Yes, we did the perfumed parks, the wonderful parks and plazas and squares and competitions. The question is, if you're going to do an urbanism, urbanism is done at $700 a foot. And by the way, it's not we who are going to actually impose that on you. Reality is going to impose that on you. So there needs to be a proposition which is cost effective. Okay? Somehow, asphalt has to exist, and somewhere the pipe has to be in the repertoire. So I put that challenge back to you. Put, just like we're going to increase our repertoire, you cannot ideologically simply say pipes. Because you know what? Scientifically, the rain that lands here can actually take a little ride to over there. It doesn't actually have to be processed right here and at tremendous cost. Put it in a pipe, take it somewhere. Believe me, Mother Nature won't even notice. She has better things to do.
The new urbanists have hundreds of projects that they can point to demonstrate what they're able to deliver in the way of, you know, dense, walkable urban places. And the landscape urbanists have almost nothing to point to in the way of projects that have produced anything in the way of real urban habitat. So I think Waldheim's claim on that score is bogus.
Yeah.
You know, Andres makes a good point about, you know, the distinction between nature and artifice of nature, you know, an attempt to artificially recapitulate it. And, you know, to go back to one of my previous points, that's exactly what Olmsted was about. And that was pretty much what Ian McCarg was trying to get to with Design with Nature. And so it's well within that American tradition of, you know, essential biophilia, the idea that we're in this fresh, green, new world, the idea that the new world, nature, freshness can save us from all of the horrible claptrap of human history and all of the terrible things that mankind has done to the planet. And this is an old, old theme in American life, and we need to find a balance in it. Charles Waldheim complained about the new urbanists turning to Europe for models for understanding urbanism. Whenever I go to Europe, I never cease to be impressed with how well they have woven the urban environments together with the surrounding landscape, which is not necessarily wilderness, of course. It's almost always a pastoral or agricultural landscape, you know. In the case of Italy, for example, where you can be standing on the Campo, which is the central square of Vienna, and, you know, you can go through the, there's a kind of a semi-permeable edge to it with, I think it's the municipal building under the tower. I don't quite remember, but, you know, you pass through this, and you go beyond that, and you get a transition into the rural landscape after that that's really remarkable. And that's almost exactly what we're unable to do in America, is have any graceful transitions between what we understand to be the human part and what we understand to be the natural part. And lacking these graceful transitions, you know, we have nothing to instruct us for how to do it. And so we've constantly been at war with ourselves and attempting to make up for our urban blunders by ruralizing the city and bringing the country into the city. And, you know, so far we haven't gotten over it. The new urbanists are trying to get us over it, and it's been quite a struggle for them, and we'll see where we go from here.
Well, Jim, I went to the bar after I listened to this talk, and I spoke with some of the next generation new urbanists, some folks from DPZ. And here's a question I recorded in the bar for you in response. I thought this might be a nice way to take out the show. So let me play the question for you right now. Just say your name and where you work.
Katia Hansen. I'm from DPZ.
And your question?
I would be really interested if, Jim, if you can see any worth in what Waldheim is saying that could be applied, and any worth whatsoever, and in any small portion in what Waldheim is saying to the coming expected decline. And I would also be curious what you think about Waldheim's urbanism, and really to hear you expand more about urbanism. You know, Waldheim takes it to be Tower in the Park, to be extremely dense, not even dealing with intensity or the idea of transect.
So do you see anything redeeming in what Charles Waldheim is talking about, Jim?
Yeah, probably the most redeeming part of it is that it represents a kind of continuing failure of the academic community, which has been in urban design ideology failure for decades, to really find its way back into a serious kind of urbanism. And because of that, it really does end up seeding the serious discussion to the new urbanists. What you have is a bunch of people jumping up and down and saying, we're environmentally sensitive and you're not. Yeah. And that's just not going to be the way that we're going to go forward. It's not enough to just posture for environmental heroism and, put on your green superhero suit and present yourself, strut about, and look for, moral brownie points for being superior. So it ends up being about, it ends up about them wanting to be superior. And I don't really see how it is an advance over their decades-long immersion in modernist dogma that, left us with an urban condition that was as degraded as it is.
Well, and to address the second half of that question, and it's a question that I have myself, I don't see anything urban about landscape urbanism. It's more like landscape architecture or landscape site planning. Maybe I'm just hoarding over the term urban.
I don't think the projects are there yet, and the reason I think the projects are not there is because they have not presented any way to incorporate real urbanism. Right. They're really just moving earth around, and they don't have much to offer besides a high tech kind of park.
Right.
And since we are facing a problem that is going to involve the decomplexifying of our life, I don't really think that making things more high-tech is necessarily going to be the answer to how we, inhabit the landscape.
I don't think that people living in subterranean anthills is going to solve the problem either, because I hear people kicking that around too, that humanity needs to go underground. And
well, there's all kinds of sort of semi-utopian models like Arco Santi, that Palo Solari project that's been going on in the Southwest desert for, 30 or 40 years. And, it affects to be some kind of a new age, evolution of a better human environment. But it's really just a high-tech utopian megastructure. And I'm quite confident that the future is not going to be about megastructures of any kind. So, whatever kind of utopian disposition of things we do get, it ain't going to be that. But, it's not all, it's also not going to be just about heroically going about building parks to make us feel better about having built shitty cities.
Okay, well, Jim, thanks a lot for talking with me. We really made you work pretty hard this week.
Yeah, it was tough, but we slogged through it.
There was a lot to go through, but
good thing I have my official landscape urbanist rubber boots on.
All right, till next time.
Okay, bye.
You've been listening to the KunstlerCast featuring James Howard Kunstler. To leave a listener comment, call toll-free at 866-924-9499. Send email to letters@kunstlercast.com. You can listen to all of our past programs, join our email list, find out how to book Jim to speak in your area, and talk about the show with other listeners at kunstlercast.com. I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Thanks for listening.